All right. Well, Kufar Akbar, everybody, hello. This is another edition of Radio Free Kafiristan. This is a radio program dedicated to rightly dividing the truth between Christianity and Islam. We examine the evidence for both of these faiths in order to arrive at the truth that leads us to the sin. Thus go I. Shalom. Peace and blessings, everyone. This is your humble host once again, Eric Thickaper, coming to you live from the cavernous depths of the Kafir Cave in Dar al-Harb, Kafiristan. We are here every Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That would be New York time. And 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, which is Chicago time. Tonight I'm livecasting on my Facebook page. And also, well, that's it. Normally I'm doing about four or five different things during the course of the show. I'll have Facebook going on one camera, and I'll have Zoom going on the other, and then YouTube. It gets to be a nightmare. So I'm trying to just stick to one thing. And tonight it just happens to be Facebook. All right. Remember, a kafir is someone who does not heed the beliefs and prescriptions held by the religion of Islam. This is according to the new Encyclopedia of Islam, dated 2001. So when we hear the pejorative term kafir or kufar used towards people who do not bow to Mecca five times a day, that's why I embrace the term. It kind of sticks. And of course, when you embrace a term like that, where are you from? Well, you're from Kafiristan, naturally. If you want to call into the show tonight, tonight's call-in number, like every Tuesday night, is area code 319-527-6706. Let me say it again real slow. Area code 319-527-6706. I really don't have a monologue tonight. I just wanted to jump right into the material because there's a lot that I want to talk about tonight. I was thinking of leading off with current events, but I thought that this was a little more important. And the reason why I believe this is when we look at this specific belief system of Islam, it's all predicated and based on the Quran. So if you understand the Quran, the origins of the Quran, and how it came into existence, then you'll be better equipped to either believe it or not believe it. And if you believe it, then you're going to have to answer some pretty hard questions that are going to be pointed at it this evening. Now, if you listen in on Sundays we have a show here also. It's called The Real Interfaith Dialogue here on Blog Talk Radio. But if you jump over to Zoom, I list it in Zoom also, and we call it the Cross and the Crescent. And I have that on a YouTube page where I have that show dedicated specifically to a YouTube page. So you can watch it over there also. But today we're going to be talking about anachronisms. This past Sunday we tried to discuss a problem with the Quran. The topic of the show was problems with the Quran. And one of the problems with the Quran is that it insists that we will find Muhammad prophesied of in the Bible. And there are several places and passages that Muslims do use, Islamic apologists use, when they try to affirm that statement. They'll go to Isaiah 29:12, where it talks about the unlettered prophet or somebody who cannot read. And Islamic tradition states that Muhammad was illiterate. And so, therefore, that person in Isaiah 29:12 has to be Muhammad. They also go to Isaiah 42, which I can't exactly remember how the argument goes for that, but they insist that it is those people from Sela, or I'll embarrass myself by trying to quote what it says, but that doesn't wash either. They even go to Solomon, the Song of Solomon, which is a love letter between King Solomon and one of his 800 wives, and say that Muhammad is somehow prophesied there because it uses a word that sounds like Muhammadin. And this is what David Wood and a lot of his videos call a phonic fallacy, and a lot of other people say that you just can't impose an Arabic understanding of a word upon the Hebrew language. So that doesn't wash either. But in the Quran, it says that you will find him in the Torah and the Injil, and the Injil meaning the Gospels. Now, when we search the Gospels, do we find Muhammad anywhere? Of course not. Any Bible-believing Christian is going to say, no, of course not. We don't find Muhammad prophesied there. But Islamic apologists, again, will insist once again that we do find him in the Injil, in the Gospel, in the most notably in the Gospel of John, chapters 14, 15, and 16, and in 17, where it speaks of the Holy Spirit, the Paraclete, being sent by Jesus to comfort the disciples, the comforter. Well, Islamic apologists will say that, well, no, that is Muhammad, the comforter. But that doesn't wash either, and that doesn't follow and doesn't make any sense at all if you are following what the New Testament of the Gospel of John actually says, and the Gospel of John actually calls it the Holy Spirit. But on top of that, it says that the Holy Spirit will be with the disciples of Jesus. And by any date reckoning, we can determine that what Muhammad was not alive at the time of the disciples. He didn't live for another 550 years or whatever it was. It was a long time after that. I see Warp showed up in chat today. Thank you so much for coming, Warp. I see you there. So what we were focused on Sunday was Deuteronomy 18:18, and this is the most popular passage that they go to. And in Deuteronomy 18:18, it says, I will raise up for you a prophet like Moses, who will I put my words into his mouth, and you will do what he says, or said something along those lines. And so we spent the good part of the show on Sunday discussing with a very popular Muslim debater by the name of Nadir Ahmed. And I will say for Nadir, he does a very good job of articulating his views. He's a very good and well-schooled debater. He uses a lot of debating that you would normally learn in high school on a debating team, but he's very effective with it. Words like, well, you have to accept that as fact. Well, the fact is, and he'll use that word continually, trying to establish his position and lead the other people to embrace his position versus the other. And but his problem was that he had 5 points that he wanted to make, and there was only two main ones that I thought that were pertinent. The first one was, he said that Muhammad was a warrior prophet and that Moses was a warrior prophet also. And I had Nadir on the show about a year and a half ago, it's been 2 years now. I'm not exactly sure. It's been a while. And we discussed this very thing on the show. And he was on 2 weeks in a row, believe it or not. When he mentioned this in the first week, that would you agree that Moses and Muhammad were both warrior prophets? And, knowing and believing some of the stories of Moses in the Bible, the character of Moses in the Bible, and you think, well, okay, maybe that does make some sense. But when you go back and read the Bible, there is no case in which Moses engaged in any type of warrior activity. He was a leader, kind of like the president, but the president or the secretary of defense are not warriors. They are administrators, and in this case, they would be the prophets. So this correlation did not work, and I think it upset him quite a bit, as a matter of fact. If you go back and listen to the broadcast, it did upset him quite a bit. And the other one was that they both made mass migrations. For an example, it uses the Exodus of Moses we find in the book of Exodus. And in the book of Exodus, we see Moses leading millions of people out of bondage in Egypt with the divine intervention of God. God providing that Shekinah glory cloud, guiding them by night, and also, if you remember, parting the Red Sea, providing them while they're wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. But there's just so many differences here, because number one, Moses never made it to the Promised Land. He died prior to going into during the 40 years of wandering, and it was Joshua who actually led him into the promised land, whereas Muhammad actually made it to Medina. But more importantly, Muhammad did not lead anybody out of Mecca. He escaped Mecca in the middle of the night and migrated to Medina, and his followers, all maybe about 150 of them, not thousands, not hundreds of thousands, not millions, but about 150 migrated to Medina. So when you look at these two points, these main points that he was making, there's just no comparison. So it was a complete and utter fail. And then Nadir, I could see that, he was getting very frustrated from all of the counterpoints because he wasn't used to this. He had sent me an email that included a debate that he had done a couple weeks ago with a fellow from Australia by the name of Sam Green. Sam Green was basically doing the same thing that I had done a year and a half ago. I was just, Green, okay, sounds like there was a Hijra, there was an Exodus, okay, they sound similar. There was a, they both were warrior prophets. Well, after you go back and you do your homework, it wasn't true. And so he left the show with about maybe 20 minutes left or 30 minutes left, upset, frustrated, and badly beaten, I might add. All right, let's jump over to the contents of today's show. Today's show, we're going to be talking about a huge problem in the Quran known as anachronisms. Now, I know this is kind of a fancy $3 word, and technically in all actuality, it really isn't. It's a way to describe events in the Quran that should not be there. An event or a thing. As a matter of fact, I have a definition for it here. So this is an act. The definition of an anachronism is an act of attributing a custom event to which it does not belong. And let's just give you a good example of this. Let's say that when Betsy Ross was sewing the first American flag for General Washington, and when she's trying to develop an idea, she's, selecting certain colors of cloth, and she's trying to decide on a design, and felt that the cloth that she had just was not bright enough. So she put it in her Kenmore wash machine and washed it thoroughly and brightened it up, hung it up on the lines, and was able to get a great color of it. And then she sews it together with the stars and the stripes and the blue portion and all the stars, the 13 stars there, presents it to General Washington, and he accepts it as the national emblem for the Continental Army. Now, most things and just about everything in that story is true. And a lot of the stories that we find in the Quran, many of the points are true. They are attributed to the Bible or other extant, would say, existing stories that existed in Arabia at that time. But there's always a kernel of truth that comes out that exposes the story or the person telling the story as a liar. And in this case, we find several of them in the Quran. And I want to cover a couple of them tonight that are really clear, that are obviously clear, obviously anachronisms, or we can say that these stories are anachronistic, demonstrating that the person who was telling the story didn't know what he was talking about. He was just attributing some facts that he knew as being true, but then he incorporates anachronisms into it, which expose him for being false, or in this case, a false prophet. And I want to start with Surah 12:20, chapter 12, verse 20 of the Quran. And this is talking about how Joseph, when we find in the book of Genesis, Joseph in chapter 37, is sold into slavery by his brothers. He's sold into slavery because he's, Abraham's, or not Abraham, Jacob, I'm sorry, Abraham, duh, Jacob's favorite son. He's the child of his old age, and he dotes on the kid. He makes him, if you remember, the coat of many colors, of course. Well, his brothers become very, they become angry at this. They resent Joseph for this. And rightly so. Joseph has dreams. If you remember, he has this dream of his brothers bowing down to him all these other things. And it drove him mad. So they finally get mad, and they club him over the head, throw him in a pit, and then they see some Ishmaelites, I might add, coming through the land of Canaan, and they sell their dear brother into slavery for the price of 20 shekels. Now you flip this over to the Quran. And you look at chapter 12, verse 20, and it says Joseph's brethren sold him for a miserable price, for a few dirhams counted out in such low estimation they hold him. Now, there's two main problems with this, clearly demonstrating this is an anachronism. Number one, dirhams, which is the derivative of Greek drachmas, which existed in the 7th century Arabia, did not exist at the time of Joseph. So this is an anachronism, saying, look, they're using this currency here to buy Joseph. Well, we know this is not true. Why? Because they didn't exist. I mean, the Greek Empire didn't exist until the 4th century B.C. This is 18th century B.C. We're only like 1,600 years off. But the second thing, and this is most important, in the Bible it describes it as 20 shekels. Now, if you know anything about a shekel is not a coin, or at least at that time it was not a coin. A shekel is a weighted measure of coinage or gold or silver at this. I believe it was silver at this time. They sold 20 shekels of silver. 20. It might have been gold. I might be wrong on this, but it's immaterial. It's a weighted amount. It's like a gram, an ounce, or something akin to that. Coins in the 18th century B.C. did not exist. So when Muhammad comes along in the 7th century AD, which is what, 2,500 years later? Yeah, 2,500 years later, and says that they sold Joseph into slavery for, and he doesn't even name the amount. And this is how you can always tell somebody who's making it up on the fly, who's not being truthful and forthright. They always use, or they're very vague and ambiguous when describing specifics. And here you can see he's not being a few dirhams. Well, a currency, number one, that didn't exist. But number two, and more importantly, a coinage did not exist. And I this is very important to me anyway, because if you are a Muslim and you actually believe this, then you're going to have to make up, or you're going to have to come up with some pretty good reasons why you believe something like this. So you're going to have to tell us, why do you believe this, when we know historically, from a historical perspective, from an archaeological perspective, this is impossible. You can't attribute coinage to the 18th century BC, but here it does. So I went to the most popular Islamic apologist website, as far as I know anyway, called Islamic Awareness. And Islamic Awareness has this article in this. And if you print out this article, it's like 15 pages of 12 font, making excuse, trying to explain this away. And they get so far out there where, just a common reader would get lost trying to figure out what they were saying. But what they cited was is that they cited the work from this book, and I can't remember the title of the book off the top of my head, and I apologize for that. I should have that in my notes here, but I didn't. But basically the title of the book was The Time When There Were No Coins. This is something along those lines. That's what they got their source from. And what they're doing is they're citing these like pseudo coins. They look like springs or something like this. And said, see, this could have existed in 1800 BC. And the fact of the matter is since it did not exist in the 18th century BC, we know that this is an anachronism. And we know that when Muhammad was saying this, and you got to keep in mind, he was talking to, or he was preaching to, people who were largely illiterate. Now, I don't mean that to cast an aspersion on the people of 7th century Arabia, because the majority of the people were. That's just a fact. They were illiterate. It doesn't mean that they were stupid, but they were illiterate, and they were not aware of the world around them. They were not aware of history. They did not know how to apply the historical method. They did not have the practice of archaeology back then to understand what the past taught. They had only heard certain things, around the campfire. This is how, things were transmitted back then. They didn't have, radios, TVs. They didn't have, the internet or Google or Facebook or Blog Talk Radio, I might add. to aid them in this. This is the only thing that they had. So they believed that they would believe it. He said, well, it sounds like it's true. A lot of that story sounds true. It says Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. So this must be true. This guy must be a prophet. So if he sounded like a prophet, he was a prophet according to them. All right. That is anachronism number 10. The second one we are going to find in the Quran, where it talks about Muhammad making his famous night journey to the furthest mosque. In this story, we have Muhammad traveling from the city of Mecca on the back, or I'm sorry, Medina, on the back of a winged horse, a fabled winged horse. And when he reaches the furthest mosque, he then proceeds up into heaven, and he encounters Moses, and he encounters Abraham, and he actually meets God. And this is the story where he, when he meets God, God says, well, look, you have to pray. You know, he goes up to the seventh heaven where God is, and you have to pray, you know, 100 times a day, bowing towards, you know, the Qibla. And so he says, okay, that sounds good. And he comes down from heaven. He goes down, get into the fifth, fourth heaven. I can't remember where Moses is. And he encounters Moses. And Moses says, no, that's way too many. That's way too many prayers. Are you crazy? You can't pray 100 times a day. That's all you would be doing is praying. So you need to go back up and talk to God and get those prayers, the number of times you have to pray, down. So he goes back up to God. And God tells him 50 prayers, and it gets down to, you know, 20. I can't remember what the numbers were, but he goes back and forth. And by the time he gets done and gets to Moses, it's down to 5 prayers a day. And Moses is like, okay, that's good enough. Now, number one, when you listen to this story, number one, it sounds very similar to the story that we find with Abraham and Lot and the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is where God comes to Abraham and tells him that he's going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah for their sin. And Abraham, you know, prays to God and says, look, if I find 50 righteous men there, will you spare the city? And God says, yes, of course I will. And Abraham prays again, and he says, if you find 30, of course I will. 20, yes, of course I will. And he gets it down to 10. If you find 10 righteous people, will you still spare the city? Did I say destroy? I think I said destroy. My fault. We spare the city. And God says, yes, if you can find 10 righteous men, I will spare the city. Well, of course, we all know the story that, you know, he did not, because he could not find 10 righteous men in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, this story that we find in the Quran is very, very similar to that, but it just, instead of sparing the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, it deals with the number of prayers that Muslims have to perform on a daily basis. But that's not the anachronism that we find in the story. The anachronism that we find in the story is that he goes to the furthest mosque. Here's what the Quran says. It says, glory to be to him who made his servant to go on a night journey from the sacred mosque to the remote mosque of which we have blessed the precinct, so that we may show him some of our signs. Surely he is hearing the seeing. And this furthest mosque, or this mosque which from the sacred mosque to the remote mosque, this remote mosque that they're talking about, Muslims will tell us, is the Dome of the Rock that we find in Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock is it's said to be the furthest mosque, which is meant to commemorate the night journey that Muhammad made from Medina to Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem to heaven to meet God. Well, there's a problem with that. Number one, we don't find anywhere in the original architecture of the Dome of the Rock any mention of this night journey. As a matter of fact, in the inner and outer ambulatories on the Dome of the Rock, all we find are a few Quranic verses that deny the deity of Christ, deny the Trinity. We find the famous verse, say not three, do not say that Jesus was a god. So when we look at this, to me, it's a shrine that is trying to demonstrate that Jesus is not God incarnate, and is trying to deny that Jesus was who he said he was. But more importantly, this mosque was built by the fifth caliph might be the sixth caliph, Abd al-Malik was his name. And it was built in 691 AD. Now, if you're listening and you're paying attention to the dates here, you can see why this is an anachronism. And the reason why it's an anachronism is because Muhammad died in 632 AD. This mosque was not built until 691. How can Muhammad make a night journey to it? How can that be true? How can there be a furthest mosque when no one in Jerusalem at this time had even heard of Allah, had ever heard of Muhammad or Muslim? There was no mosque there. The Al-Aqsa Mosque that sits on the end of the Temple Mount today wasn't built until 705 AD. So that's a good, 14 years after the Dome of the Rock was built. So the bottom line is that when you look at this verse here, that you can clearly see that this is anachronistic. If Muhammad is claiming to have traveled to a mosque, and we know that we know when the mosque was built, and that mosque was built after the time that he was supposed to travel there, we know that this is, again, another anachronism that we find in the Quran. All right, let's move on to the next one. The next one is kind of neat because this deals with King David. King David, the most famous patriarch from all of Judaism. As a matter of fact, if you go to Israel today, he's one of the most revered people in that country. They always, when Jews look back on their history, they always look back to that period of when David was king. So when we look at this verse here, these two verses here, it's in chapter 34, verses 11 and 10. It says, "We bestowed grace time on David from ourselves. O ye mountains, sing ye back the praises of Allah with him, and ye birds also." So far, so good. So far, so good. Sounded kind of like a psalm to me. "And we made the iron soft for him, commanding, make thou coats of mail, balancing well the rings of chain armor." Oops. Oops. A big old oops right there. And here's why. Where it says, "commanding, make thou coats of mail, balancing well the rings of chain mail, or chain armor, rings of chain armor," is what it says. Now, the problem is that the chain mail, this ringed mail, that it was very, very popular in 7th century Arabia, 7th century period, didn't exist at the time of David. David lived about the 10th century BC, about 1000 BC. Chainmail was not invented, let alone propagated in that region until the 5th century BC. And it was invented by, the earliest example of this is by the Celts in England. You see a problem here. So when you're attributing chainmail to David, that's anachronistic. That's the same thing as having having Betsy Ross using a Kenmore washing machine to wash the cloth for the first American flag. That's a big anachronism. So when you look at chainmail, when you look at what was the last one? My memory is going on me. When you look at the furthest mosque not existing, and when you look at coins being used when coins had never been used or had not been invented at that time, you can see anachronism after anachronism after anachronism. But that's not the end of them. I got plenty more where that came from. This next one comes from Surah 12, verse 41. And this deals again with Pharaoh. And here's what, you know, this is the thing with Pharaoh hated the Jews. So he's attributing all kinds of evil things to Pharaoh, which is, you know, I would too. If I'm out there making it up, I'm going to make Pharaoh look like the most evil guy in the world. And that would be hard, you know, considering the things that he did to the Jews. But here you have in Surah 12, verse 41, verse 41, and also Surah 12, 71, you have people being crucified. people are being crucified. Now, at this time that he is describing, he's describing two different time periods. He's describing Pharaoh at the time of Joseph, and he's describing Pharaoh at the time of Moses. These two lived about 400 years apart. So he's describing that crucifixion was used in the court of Pharaoh during the time of Joseph, about 1800 BC, and he's using the practice of crucifixion being used by Pharaoh at the time of Moses, which is about 1400 BC. His big old problem. Crucifixion wasn't invented until, let me see here, when did I have this? Method of crucifixion was not practiced during the time of them. Okay, the former lived during the 19th, okay, the latter lived in, because it wasn't practiced, the bottom line, it wasn't invented until the 6th century BC. There's no recorded usage of crucifixion until the Persians start using it in around 600 BC, the 6th century BC. He's only 1,000 years off. I get it. But again, an anachronism. Crucifixion is an anachronism. Chainmail is an anachronism. The absence of the Dome of the Rock is an anachronism. And using coins to buy Joseph, sell Joseph into slavery is an anachronism. But I have more. Oh, I have more. Let's see here. Okay, this just describes, that slide just describes the process. I'm sorry. It describes the process of crucifixion. The next one is Moses and the Samaritans. Now this, I know some of you, what, Samaritans in Moses? Yeah, it's right here in the Quran, don't you know? We read in Surah chapter 20, verses 35 to 88 and 95, and I'm just going to use a small segment of it here to give you an example of what he's talking about. And it says that a Samaritan led the people of Israel to create the golden calf during the time of Moses, shortly following the exodus of Egypt. Problem with this, that wasn't the verse, I'm sorry, that was just a statement. The problem with this is that the city of Samaria did not exist until, I think it's 7 centuries after the time of the exodus, probably longer, if memory serves me correct. The Syrian Empire was around the 8th century BC. This is what the 16th, maybe 600 years, but he's on, let's just make it easy. Let's say he's 500 years off. That's, that's half a millennia. And he's having Samaritans. He says, he, Allah, said, we have tempted the people since thou didst lead them. The Samaritan has led them into error. Then Moses returned and we cast them, the gold. Anyway, here you have the Samaritan being mentioned in the Quran. Well, how can you have a Samaritan helping Moses and Aaron create a calf, or helping Aaron create this calf, leading the Jew people of Israel astray, if the people group didn't exist for 700 years, 600 years, or 500 years? How can that be? This is an anachronism. The people in 7th century Arabia did not understand the historical method, and so therefore they would believe whatever was thrown at them. They were, again, an oral culture, and there's nothing wrong with having oral cultures. It's just that they're not very concise or precise in their application of history and understanding historical facts, and this is an anachronism. You have a Samaritan helping Aaron create a golden calf. You have Pharaoh, 1400, 1800 BC, using crucifixion, 700 years prior to the practice of crucifixion being invented. You have David wearing chainmail, where chainmail had not been invented for over 500 years prior to this. You have the Dome of the Rock being in existence. This would be at least 60 years prior to the event that it is spoken of, being the furthest mosque. And then you also have Joseph being sold into slavery. Again, and an anachronism. Here's my favorite. This one, as a matter of fact, we discussed a couple weeks ago on the Real Interfaith Dialogue, is how we know Moses, or not Moses, Muhammad was historically illiterate. Because in 4 different spots in the Quran, he has describes Mary, the mother of Jesus, also as the sister of Aaron, Now, who is Aaron? Well, we just mentioned Aaron. Aaron was the one that was the brother of Moses. When did Aaron and Moses live? Around 1400 BC. You see a problem here? Well, of course you do, because Mary lived in the first century AD, or actually the first century BC, first century BC, first century AD. 1400 years later. But in Surah 2030, in Surah 1928, and in Surah 6612, she's mentioned as the sister of Aaron. And the sister of Moses, actually, in, well, what was it? I think it was 1928, I think it was. But more importantly, or no, that was chapter 23 of the Quran. But more importantly, you get a very detailed analysis and family structure outlined in Surah 3, verses 33 through 45. And this is the one that when you ask Muslims about this, they'll try to avoid it, and they'll try to go to chapter 19 or chapter 20. And the reason why is they'll say, well, Mary is only referred to as the sister of Aaron in a familia type way, where she's just part of the family. Well, that doesn't wash when you look at chapter 3, verses 33 to 45, because it gives Imran, who is the father of Aaron and Moses, and Maryam, their sister as defined in Genesis, and you also have, or I'm sorry, just Exodus, and you also have they're the wife of Imran, then you have Mary, and then all of a sudden Zacharias pops into this, and then Mary is being taken care of by Zacharias. Mary then is mentioned as the mother of Jesus. So again, this is an anachronism. This is a huge anachronism, a huge historical error. There are so many others. So just let's quickly review here. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was not the sister of Aaron, the sister of Moses, as portrayed in the Quran, an anachronism. Pharaoh did not practice crucifixion. That's an anachronism. It was invented for centuries later. Here, the Samaritan could not have helped Aaron at Mount Sinai building a golden calf because they did not exist for 700 years after the fact. You had David wearing chainmail. That wasn't invented for 500 years after his time. Then you have the furthest mosque, the Dome of the Rock, which didn't exist until 60 years after the death of Muhammad. And then you have Joseph being sold into slavery. Did not happen, or did not exist at that time. And the last one I'm going to cover tonight before we move into the news, which I'm thinking you're probably glad, you're just like, would you please hurry it up with this? But it's so important to understand that these blatant errors clearly demonstrate, clearly, objectively demonstrate that the Quran is not in any way, shape, or form the revealed word of God. God would not make errors, blatant, big, old, fat, juicy errors like this. And the last one is kind of an aside because it deals with the story of Esther. In the Quran, we find in chapter 28, verses 5 through 8, the mention of the antagonist in the sister, or in the story, in the book of Esther, Haman. And we know how Haman went out to try to destroy the Jewish people during the Persian Empire? Pretty certain it was during the Persian Empire. He's trying to destroy the Jewish people. Well, so Muhammad says, okay, well, Haman wants to destroy the Jewish people. Pharaoh wants to destroy the Jewish people. So the both must have colluded at the same time. So what he has Haman doing is he's a servant in the court of Pharaoh. I know. That makes zero sense. Now, when we talk about the Persian Empire, we're talking 6th century B.C., and when we look in Surah 28:38, here's what it says. And Pharaoh said, O chiefs, I know that you have no good God other than me. So kindle me a fire, O Haman, to bake the mud and set up for me a lofty tower in order that I may survey the God of Moses. Lo, I deem him of the liars. Now, number one, I mean, when we look at this, when you look at this, here you have the Pharaoh building the Tower of Babel. That's essentially what that's alluding to. I can't prove that, but I mean, when you talk about bake mud, so kindle me a fire to bake the mud and set up for me a lofty tower, and then I may survey the God. You know, that sounds a lot like the Tower of Babel. I might be wrong on that. I'm willing to be wrong on that. Maybe he's, I don't know, maybe he's building a big pyramid. Who cares? But the bottom line is Haman did not live at the time of Moses. He did not, or at the time of the Pharaoh. And he most certainly did not live in Egypt. Haman is not an Egyptian name. When you look at all, and I looked this up, and I might not have found it, but I did look, and I looked diligently through multiple sources, trying to find any reference to a name by the name of Haman in any Egyptian literature, in any Egyptian hieroglyphs, in any Egyptian wording, anything out there. Like I said, I'm willing to be wrong on that, but I am 99.9% positive that there was not any name used in ancient Egypt, recorded name in ancient Egypt, any documents from ancient Egypt of Haman. Now, what we do find is we do find recorded names of Jews, very Jewish names recorded in some of the old documents and manuscripts that exist or that we have in our possession today. But we do not have the name of Haman among them. That is a Persian name. That is not an Egyptian name. That is not a Hebraic name. Very unique, and it clearly demonstrates that this is another one of many anachronisms that we find in the Quran. And I am going to stop right there, and I am sure everybody and their brother, let me do this so I can get this on the speaker here, will say. I'm thinking they're probably saying, all right, thank God you're done with that. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the second half of the show. Look at there, I'm like at 43 minutes, and the show's an hour and a half. I timed that pretty well. I'm getting better at this. I'm thinking I might have to start asking for a salary, don't you know? Yeah, go figure. That ain't ever going to happen. I've been told to keep my day job. All right, let's go ahead and look at some of these news articles that we have for the day. The dog's right here. Sit down, boy. You get off me. We have today, and I'm only using two news sources that I go to. It's kind of like the Drudge Report. I use Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch, and I use Bonnie's Bare Naked Islam. They always have this plethora of articles that you can go ahead and read that deal with Islamic issues across the globe. So we're going to start with Robert Spencer's article here, Jihad Watch, found today. It says Pakistan, you know, that bastion of what do we call utopian application of Sharia law, where all human rights are recognized, every single citizen not of the country. It says Pakistan Muslim NGO denies food to poor Hindus and Christians amid coronavirus pandemic. And here's what Robert Spencer has to say about it. The guy's brilliant. He says the reason for this is that zakat, Islamic almsgiving, is one of the five pillars and is reserved for Muslims. Islamic apologists in the West routinely deny that this is the case, but here in its action. So when you look at the application of the Sharia that we've spoken about several times in the show, which is the God-given law or the law of Allah, as codified, I don't have the book out, as codified in that jurisprudence manual of Islamic law, Reliance of the Traveler, where it says that the kafir has to pay this zakat or has to pay the jizya, and if they do not pay the jizya, then you will either fight or you will you either pay it, fight, or you're banished from the land. Or you can, you convert from Islam. So these people that live in Pakistan today, now keep in mind, Pakistan has a nuclear bomb. Pakistan does have a nuclear bomb. They have, they do have an arsenal of nuclear warhead. Them and India both. And the idea that this country that denies civil rights to non-Muslims in their country is sickening. But what do you do? I mean, what do you do with a country that's armed with a nuclear weapon? Do you go in there and say, hey, you have to change your civil rights? Well, we could go in there and we could, put in place sanctions and do things, try to change. But you're not going to change people's most deeply held religious convictions. And they are not going to give this up. So when they start denying food to non-Muslims, this is very consistent with, and I've said it several times in the show, chapter 98, verse 6, where it says that Christians and Jews are the worst of creatures. And if you're the worst of the creature, it's okay to mistreat you. And this is what we see in Islamic-dominated countries today. It includes, even the cowardly Lion of Delaware, Marshall Crybaby, listen how smart he is. Okay, he says, look at your show. You have zero likes, very few views or whatever. And every time you mention my name, I get hundreds of friends requests. Well, how does that wash? I mean, if nobody's watching this show, if nobody's listening to this show like you insist that it is, how are you getting these hundreds of friends requests? See, the guy just doesn't have a lot of luck when it comes to, cognitive practices, when it comes to, what we call thinking. And so he sends me emails like this all the time. He goes, today he screenshotted my whole Facebook page trying to make me feel bad that nobody's watching you on Facebook. Nobody's liking your videos. I really care, but he thinks it's important. So I sent him an email back, and I'm like, well, thank you for the classic case of demonstrating what people who have no life do. That's Marshall Crichton. But anyway, okay. So back to Malaysia, where then the reason I brought that up, that's where he says he is right now. Who cares? Back to this, the application of the Sharia in these Islamic-dominated countries. This is what you're going to find. You're going to have the discrimination to the point where they are going to basically starve people to death. And this is what we have there. And then the second article that he has here, Pakistan, Muslims again deny coronavirus aid to Christians. This time it's in Lahore. He goes on to say this was previously done in Karachi, as reported here, which was a previous article. And as one Muslim writer put it, it is not permissible to give alms to any kafir or unbeliever except to the one who is inclined towards Islam in the hope that he will become Muslim if you give him the alms or the zakat. So a couple things about this. Number one, the article says to any kafir. So when people call up and say, well, you're not using the right term, thakafir. Or Smith, or whatever. You're not using the right term. That's not true. That's not how the term is used. It means they used to cover. Well, what's this then? Shut up. You're not consistent. And if you have a problem with it, why don't you write this newspaper here? Blame them. Leave me alone. This is it's sick. Okay, next article. Italy. This is in Italy, my blessed Italia. I love that country. It says Muslims are living with rotting corpses rather than burying their dead relatives in non-Muslim cemeteries. Now, there's a video here on Facebook that I have, and a lot of the language is in Italian. And I'm not going to play. I was thinking, well, I'm going to play it, but I'm just going to go ahead and click on this thing, because if I play it, then you're not going to understand the words, and you're going to, like, what an idiot trying to play a play a video clip that that has people speaking Italian in it. But the premise of this is that, okay, Muslims are complaining that they don't have any place to bury their dead. Well, why is that? Are there no cemeteries, open spots in cemeteries in Italy available? And if you think of Italy, Italy is a country inhabited for thousands of years. Archaeology in that country goes past 3,000 years ago. So anytime that you dig something up, you're going to find some type of archaeological discovery in that country. So are you saying that there are no places or spots to bury dead people in Italy anymore? No. No, that's not what they're saying. These people are lamenting the fact that they don't have any places to bury their dead in Muslim cemeteries. And here's where you have a classic example without even realizing it, where they come out and they don't even realize what they're doing, is a classic example of religious supremacism. You know, people always get their undies in a bunch, and rightly so, when you start looking at people who are, you know, racist and, you know, have, you know, white supremacists and things of that nature, or any ethnic supremacists of that ilk. But here you have a classic example of Islamic supremacism. Why are there no places in Italy to bury their dead for Muslims? Because there's only 8 Muslim cemeteries. Well, why don't you go bury your dead in a public cemetery or a Christian cemetery or a cemetery that has crosses in it? Well, that's forbidden. And they teach their people that the body of the dead will be defiled if they're buried next to a Kafir. That's what they're not telling you in that article. So when that article popped up, what was that, 2 days ago, and I'm reading that, I'm like, are you, and that automatically hit me right between the eyes. I said, are you kidding me? If you want to talk about a classic example of religious supremacism, this is it. When we start talking about how they legally and without international condemnation, discriminate against non-Muslims in predominantly Islamic countries, nobody really says boo about it. But the best example of this is Mecca itself, Saudi Arabia, right there in southwestern Saudi Arabia, out there in the middle of nowhere where olive trees have never grown but are attributed to that place in the Quran. I'm getting off on a tangent. You know, that'd be a great show in the future, is to start talking about Dan Gibson's book, where he just completely demolishes the localities that we find in the Quran and the Hadiths. And it's classic. But anyway, when you get out out to Mecca, I cannot go into Mecca. There's a Vito Esposito, the chairman and president of Global Patriot Radio, has a picture normally put up on his news feed, that it has him on a motorcycle outside of Mecca. And it's underneath this sign, interstate sign. It has two directions. It has Mecca this way, and then all non-Muslims have to keep going. You can't go into Mecca, where they practice and completely agree with ethnic cleansing. There you go. Islam. This is where we start talking about religious supremacism. Now, I am not aware of any church in this country that would prohibit a Muslim from entering. But according to the Sharia, you cannot enter a mosque without permission of a Muslim. You're not allowed. So here you have, as I mentioned, a great example, of Islamic supremacism. And here's another one. It says, former Houston-based imam says non-Muslims are the worst of Allah's creations. Treat them like that. Now, where would he get that? Where would he get that? Here's what Robert Spencer's comments. He writes, he also justified Muhammad's marriage to a 9-year-old girl in violent jihad against unbelievers. How many Muslim clerics are still in the United States who believe the same way Zubir Bouchiklila, I can't pronounce his name, does? There are likely to be many, since what he says here is standard mainstream Islam, abundantly supported by Quran and Sunnah. But one cannot ask such questions. Even asking them renders one Islamophobic. Sheikh Zobeda Bulibudichki, whatever his name is, former Houston imam, deported in 2011 for immigration-related charges. Believers are the worst to go. Okay, this is just the title of the article. And I'm wondering, you know, because our favorite imam that comes on periodically onto the Cross and the Crescent show or the Real Interfaith Dialogue on Sundays is an imam from Houston. As a matter of fact, I have learned through other people on Facebook, they've told me and they've sent me the, you know, I'm a very popular topic on some of his podcasts, evidently. You know what the Thekifer said this week. You know what the Thekifer did. And I'm thinking, my goodness, somebody that doesn't have any likes, doesn't have any Facebook friends, doesn't have any, views on. He's such a popular guy. He had a podcast. I think it was last fall. Yeah. I was listening to his podcast. He had sent it to me or somebody had sent it to me. And it was dedicated to one of my shows where I was critiquing his book, Consider Islam. And you know, if you listen to the show often, you'll know that the critique that I was talking about was where he went to a fundraiser. He's criticizing Christians for being hypocrites, and rightly so. There's a lot of, you know, as a matter of fact, let me just say this. In order to be a Christian, you have to be a hypocrite, because as Christians, we're admonished to be Christ-like, live a perfect life. And anybody who's a Christian, cognizant of their faith, knows that you can't be like Christ. You cannot be perfect. You cannot be sinless. We sin every single day. And so you're a hypocrite saying, well, I want to be Christ. Well, how are you going to do that? You know you can't do that. But yet, that's what we're charged with. Well, okay, so what he does is he says, in this podcast, he goes, he's critiquing what I said. And in my broadcast, I was talking about, okay, so Kenny is upset because he goes to a fundraiser to help him pay off medical bills for his, he had a motorcycle accident. And so he goes, he has a friend who's a pastor of church, and the pastor says, there, let me hold a fundraiser for you to help you pay off those medical bills. And evidently they didn't raise, you know, but a couple $100s anyway. And Kenny mentions that. Well, they only raised a couple $100 for me anyway, which, you know, forget the fact that a Christian church is trying to help you out and you're an imam, okay? So shut up. But now the hypocrisy just reeks here. But it goes on further to where I critique what he said, because there evidently went at this fundraiser, somebody got up and at the podium and said that if you die without Christ, you're going to hell. And Kenny starts lamenting about, this guy was condemning me to hell. Now, why would he do this at my fundraiser? And I pointed out that this guy was an a-hole for doing it. And I even said it on there. I was just like, you're right. This guy was a butt for doing it. You don't do this to a guy at his fundraiser. I mean, come on. What kind of butt would do that? Well, this guy did it. So Kenny starts playing me, saying this a-hole word. But I didn't stop there, because I said, you know, I went on to describe. I said, okay, this guy's condemning you to hell. And that's what the Bible, that's what the Bible teaches. I mean, this is what Christ taught. If you, you know, I am the way, the truth, and life, any man or no man comes to the Father except by me. That's John 14:6. Christ was very explicit, lays down the gauntlet. Okay. Well, when you tell that to a Muslim, oh, you're condemning me to hell. Okay, I got it. The Bible teaches that if you die without Christ, you're going to hell. Okay, fine, it does. I get it. And to say that at that venue was wrong. But what does the Quran teach? What does the Quran teach about sending me, moi, the kuffar, to hell? It not only talks about sending me to hell, it talks about designing clothes that I have to wear that burn my flesh for all eternity. It talks about how I get to regrow my flesh for all eternity. It talks about how I'm going to eat nothing but the pus of womb. Or no, wait a second. It says the only thing that you will eat is the pus of womb. But it also says that you're going to eat like a prickly pear cactus plant or you're going to drink scalding water, but you're only going to, well, that's a contradiction that I didn't cover tonight. But that is an a-hole. And if it's not just Muhammad saying it, and if this is indeed from Allah, Allah is an a-hole, according to your standard. Well, he made this podcast, and the point I'm trying to make here is that evidently I'm a very popular person, because he's lamenting the fact of what an a-hole I was for daring to critique his tome of brilliance, Consider Islam. All right, let's go on to an article that deals with affirmative action plans for Islam. You know, if you know anything about affirmative action is a program that is designed to assist people who were disadvantaged at a previous time and that may still be disadvantaged, to provide them opportunities to better themselves. For an example, we have programs, academic affirmative action programs in this country that enable people to not meet such stringent criteria to get into colleges or universities. We have affirmative action hiring programs where we provide people lesser screening, or they don't have to meet such stringent standards to hold certain types of jobs or get into certain type of jobs. And in its inception, and when you think about, okay, well, that makes sense. You want to help people who've been previously disadvantaged, who have not had the same opportunities as you have, but it never works in its application. And I'm not going to get into the politics of it all, but it is a true statement. But anyway, the bottom line is that here, when we start looking at how the media and how the world is cowed into not criticizing Islam, here they want Islam essentially wants an affirmative action program to shield them from criticism or from scrutiny of any type. And I get this all the time, not only on this show, but also on my other show, saying, well, you're nothing but a hater, a divider, an Islamophobe, all these words that they come up with in order to silence you. And here we have a classic example of affirmative action for Islam. The title of the article is France Not Enforcing Lockdowns in Muslim No-Go Zone. And Robert Spencer again, this is actually Dan Greenfield from Jihad Watch, writes, they do not call them no-go zones for a reason. But let's not kid ourselves. There are neighborhoods in New York City and L.A. where police won't be asking crowds to go indoors, and that the media would never dream of shaming, in which you won't go viral on social media. This is the same thing, except it's a symptom of a much worse problem. There are people who follow the rules and those who don't, and those who expect others to follow the rules. So what he's referring to here is that it's those areas, those no-go zones, those predominantly Islamic Muslim no-go zones in France, they're not enforcing these quarantine laws, these forced lockdown laws. Why? Well, police just don't go into those zones. So how are you going to enforce it? And if you do try to enforce it, then you're going to have riots on your hands. They call them no-go zones for a reason. And I would also add to that, they're an abject denial of these areas. And if you would dare to criticize them, then you're the one who is shamed. Just as I mentioned here, you would shame. And I was trying to think, in some of these cities across the United States, New York has the lockdown in effect. Well, if you go into some of those neighborhoods where you have high concentrations of substance abuse and addiction, where are these people getting their substances that they abuse? Do they have a 60-day supply to get them through the pandemic? Do they? No, they don't. They have to go out and purchase these on a regular basis. And then you have to have a transportation and delivery system. And it's, you know, it's kind of like we have with our food system, you know, our food supply. Well, you have to have a good supply of drugs that these people are addicted to in these zones enforcing those laws. And that would be very interesting to see news articles. I haven't seen any news articles where they've said that they're not. But at the same time, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So, well, I'll keep my eye on that. Maybe I'll check back in with that next week. All right, the next one. This was a video that I watched, and I can't play the video, and there's not a lot of audio to it. But here again, we're in France, and medical workers, people who worked in the hospitals in some of these areas that are deemed to be no-go zones. Because let's face it, a lot of the migrants that live in these no-go zones do not have a lot of medical training, do not have a lot of doctors, nurses, LPNs, or medical personnel immigrating to France that live in these areas. So many of the people, or many of the hospitals that service these areas have to have French people, French citizens, come from different parts of the city into that area, into that hospital to provide services for these migrants. So here's the title of the article. It says, France medical workers must be escorted. Now think about this. Medical workers must be escorted by bodyguards to protect them from attacks by Muslim immigrants. This is Muslim invaders. This is because bare naked Islam, Bonnie's side. She says Muslim invaders. That's what she calls them. It cites the Labrasserie Hospital in the 10th, whatever, of Paris, 10th District of Paris, hired security agents to escort doctors, nurses, and other hospital staff when they travel to the nearby stations and metro stations. Due to its large Turkish minority, the 10th, whatever it is often called Little Turkey. So here you have doctors, nurses, having to be escorted to the train station, from the hospital to the train station, so they're not attacked or raped along the way. That's scary. That really is scary. You've lost control of your country if that is the case. You've lost control of your society. Your society is, and I'll tell you, your society is doomed if that's the case. It really is. If you are not able to protect your own citizens from just walking down the street with the expectation of safety, you've lost. This is what made the Roman Empire and the spread of Christianity so easy, is because you had the expectation of being able to travel throughout the empire freely. You had the free flow of information. You had the Roman roads. When you don't have the Roman roads, you've lost. When you do not have the ability to expect that you are going to arrive safely from one location in your country to the other location, you've lost. You've lost your society. You know, if I was to drive, let's say, from Cedar Rapids to Dubuque and not have the expectation of free travel that I might be stopped at some time while traveling, am I going to want to travel there? Am I going to want to do business in that part of the state? No, of course not. Why? Because it's just too dangerous. I'm not going to subject myself to that type of danger. So commerce is going to decrease, and the safety of those citizens that live in that region is going to greatly decrease, and they're probably going to want to move out of it. Oh, gee, by the way, that's exactly what we find in Paris. It only makes sense. But that's what they have. Vive la France. Okay, here is, again, an example of affirmative action in application for Islam. And David Wood did a video this week on this article. As a matter of fact, Robert Spencer says, David Wood offers a marvelous evisceration of Islamic apologist Craig Considine's Dawa in Newsweek in this video. Okay, this is why I picked up the video. But what this guy does, let me just read you what this guy says. Let me see if I find the, here it is. Okay, here's what he says. The COVID-19 pandemic is forcing governments and news sources to provide the most accurate and helpful advice to the world's population as the disease is indeed global in reach. Healthcare professionals are in high demand, and so too are scientists who study the transmission and effect of pandemics. Experts like immunologist Dr. Anthony Fauci, the medical reporter, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, are saying that good hygiene and quarantine or the practice of isolating from others in hope of preventing the spread of the contagious diseases are the most effective tools to contain COVID-19. Listen to what he says now. Do you know who else suggested good hygiene and quarantining during a pandemic? Muhammad, the prophet of Islam over 1,300 years ago. While he is by no means a traditional expert on matters of deadly diseases, Muhammad nonetheless has sound advice to prevent and combat a development like COVID-19. Now, listen to what he said. Muhammad said, if you hear of an outbreak of plague in a land, do not enter it. But if the plague outbreaks out of place while you are in it, do not leave that place. He also said those with contagious diseases should be kept away from those who are healthy. Okay. This is the same Muhammad who teaches you to drink camel urine for a tummy ache or if you feel bad. This is the same Muhammad that tells you that if a fly lands in your drink and one of his wings touches your drink and spreads a disease, is to take the fly and dip the other wing in the drink because the other wing has the cure. The same Muhammad that says that all water is pure, regardless if it's the same water people upstream pee in or women throw menstrual rags into. That's the same Muhammad. So here you have Islamic affirmative action being applied by, what's this guy's name? This guy, Craig Considine, kind of like Constantine, but Considine. And this is dated clear back here. This is a news. This is Newsweek, for Pete's sake, from the March 17th edition. Newsweek isn't even a magazine anymore. I don't even think they distribute the magazine anymore. I don't look for magazines anymore at stores. Everything's online now, so I don't even think they have a magazine anymore. I think that was in the David Wood video. Anyway, that was a great video. If you go over to Apologetic or X17 Apologetics on Facebook. Great resource for everything Christian apologetics, and not only just Islam, but also there's a lot of other great videos there. Okay, here's one that I am going to play a video. It says, why is ABC asking a Muslim spokes jihadist, this is Bonnie, of course, from Bare Naked Islam, from CARE about anti-Asian discrimination during, and she calls it she doesn't call it the coronavirus, she calls it the China virus pandemic. And oh, by the way, there is a meme going around Facebook that says that the CO or the C in coronavirus means China. Folks, it's not true. It's not true. So if you see that on Facebook, don't like it. Don't share it. Just let it die. It's natural death because it's not true. But anyway, here you have the title, Designated Terrorist Group CARE, which they are a designated terrorist group, CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, they are the unindicted co-conspirator of the Holy Land Money Laundering Foundation, designated terrorist organization. But let's see here. Notice how she does a quick U-turn and makes it all about discriminating against the Muslim community. Okay, so here she, this lady's being interviewed. They have a huge panel of people here, and they go to Bobby calls her a potato head. And I tell you what, when they have the burqa and you have the hijab, which is the head covering that they wear, and then they have the niqab, which is the scarf that you can wear over the face. You know, this lady should wear, I'm just saying, she should wear a niqab. But anyway, have a listen. You don't have to You don't have to be punished by the way she looks. Here we go.
I want to bring in Zare Ballou with KRSF because you work a lot with young people, especially on how to de-escalate when you're in that situation. And I'm seeing Facebook posts from people saying, if somebody confronts you with anti-Asian epithets, how should you respond?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's been, unfortunately, the lived experience of so many in our community to either be targeted directly for hate or be mistaken for someone that someone else was targeting for hate. And what we've been teaching people since the 2016 election is that it's never the responsibility of the person who is attacked to have to respond, right? Is that their primary purpose should be get out of that situation, get to safety. The obligation is on the rest of us. If I see it at a grocery store, if I see it at a parking lot, if I see it on public transit, I need to intervene and do something to protect my brother or sister in, you know, in the community and say, if I were there when I thought when this happened to Kyle, right? Like, what can I do as an observer to, you know, go from observer to upstander and protect Kyle? And there, the key thing that we tell people actually is all my interaction should be with the targeted person. We don't call them a victim. We want to give them the agency to decide what happens in that situation. So if I were with Kyle, I would have said, Kyle, what can I do to help you? Kyle, let me get to your car. Let me help you get to your car safely. I actually don't want to engage the attacker because that escalates the situation. Then they're yelling at me. Then they feel the need to make it a bigger thing, right? I'm going to take the steam entirely out of them by saying, Kyle, what can I do to help you? Engaging Kyle, ignoring the attacker, and de-escalating as soon as possible. We all want to be sarcastic. We want to be snarky. We want to fight back. But that's not the safe thing to do in this moment.
Right. Zare, thank you very much. And certainly Muslim Americans have borne more than their fair share of racism in recent years. Let me...
Okay, I don't mean to laugh at that, but come on, the show is about the coronavirus. It's about the coronavirus, okay? And what should people do in order to? And this lady is complaining about discrimination against Muslims. People calling Muslims names or nasty names or something. The show is about the coronavirus. So here's the thing that we know about CARE. Number one, you're never going to get the truth out of that organization. This is an organization that encourages members of its community to not cooperate with police when it comes to terrorist investigations. We have a pamphlet. You just look it up on the internet. There is a pamphlet that was published by CARE telling its co-religionists, telling its practitioners to keep their mouth shut if police are asking about terrorist-related activities. Do not cooperate. Keep your mouth shut. This is that type of organization. And any time that they can get – I have never heard – and this is like listening to Ilhan Omar. I have never heard positive word about our country from this organization. Never. Never a celebration of its of the ability of Muslims in this country to practice openly and freely their religion. Never any mention of the special protections afforded to religious minorities in this country under federal law and state laws. Never any mention of that. The only thing that you get from this hating organization. They're just a bunch of haters. They hate our country. They hate everything that our country is founded upon, all the principles our country is founded upon, free speech, freedom of religion, all of these things. And then they use them to their own advantage to try to proselytize their own religion, which teaches the exact opposite thing. With that said, here you have a classic example of what CARE is all about. And nobody cares about CARE. And here is another great example of affirmative action for Islam in place. Title of the article, If you're in Seattle, don't dare call a Muslim a raghead because Seattle police chief is giving priority to 9/11 alleging racist name calling. Now, you kind of raise your eyebrows. What the heck is this about? You know, is she being accurate? Is she mischaracterizing this or what? And here's what her lead says. It's amid the worldwide pandemic, Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best is asking citizens to call 911 to report hate crimes. In an unbelievable video featuring Seattle's police chief and a retired journalist on Twitter, Best pleads with citizens to call 911, even if they're not sure it's a hate crime, or incredibly to call if they just think that people might have been a victim of hate speech. So in one of the ground zeros, the one of the hot spots of this country, where we have a global pandemic brewing, where hundreds of people have already succumbed to this disease, the police chief in Seattle, Washington, is prioritizing 9/11 calls or asking people to call. And in this article, and the article is actually pretty good, but I don't have time to go through it. But there was a video here. There was a video that was embedded here that actually has a college professor from UCLA that tells us what hate speech is and what hate speech is not. And calling someone, and I would never use this as a pejorative term. I do not, you know, I don't get in the gutter when people start calling names. It's just bad business. It just shows how shallow of a character you have when you start doing that. But if you were to call somebody a raghead, should that be a federal crime? Calling somebody an N-word, should that be a federal crime? Is it offensive? Yeah, you bet it is. Is it provocative? Yeah. You bet it is. But is it a crime? Is it a crime? Is it something that should be reported to police? Now, I could understand if somebody is using those types of terms to provoke somebody into committing violence, to goad somebody into a fight. I could understand that. And in a lot of cases, in the legal sense, that's true. But just to report somebody for using the term, as you find in the articles, what this police chief said, is absolutely ridiculous and is absolutely a great example of how desperate this belief system is in order to be protected from any type of criticism and scrutiny. Okay. Let's do this. Nope, I already did that. That was Pakistan. I'm going to leave that alone. Here's a great article. Where were the first coronavirus vaccine come from? Let me guess. Well, the article goes on to say what type of research is done, what type of facilities that each country possesses, and where we would expect these studies and these potential vaccines to be developed and why they would be developed there. But it goes on to say, but among the 40 or so research groups now working in a half dozen countries on the coronavirus vaccine, none were found to be in any of the 57 Islamic countries, Muslim countries that are members of the Organization of Islamic Conference. And this is one of the issues that I discussed a number of months ago when I made a comment in passing that there hasn't been any inventions, I don't know if I said this, any inventions from the Islamic world or something along those lines, where they can't even, engineer, design, and build lawnmowers in any of these countries from the OIC. And I get this from the Cowardly Lion of Doha, this article. They too have invented things in Islamic countries. He sends me this list of examples, and one of them was a luggage rack at an airport. Look at here, we have to build a luggage rack. Or another one was like a shower cabinet. Was a shower cabinet. God, I tell you, the quality entertainment alone from that guy is priceless. But here, it's clear that when we look for a vaccine, a promising vaccine, and it isn't that I don't wish this, that these countries could not develop this. It's just that their education system in these countries has to follow strict Sharia. And when you do that, there's no opportunity for free inquiry. There's no opportunity to dissent, of dissent, to question. And that is covered in, again, under the Sharia, the reliance of the travel. You can't question anything that's in the Quran. If you were to say something that would be counterintuitive to the Quran. You could have a fart put out on you. I mean, you could have a legal ruling placed that said you can't say that. And if you say it, well, you're guilty of apostasy. And if you're guilty of apostasy, there's a wide variety of punishments that can be imposed upon you that include cutting your head off. So they have to tread very carefully in those countries. And, you know, you just, your heart bleeds for people like that because they don't have the opportunities and the things that we know here in the West. Okay, last article, and this is the nail in the coffin. It's funny more than anything else. And I'm just talking about where would we expect this vaccine to come from, and the major places that where this vaccine is they're trying to develop this vaccine is the United States and Israel. Yes, and in Israel. So this next article deals with the title of it is the hypocrisy. Virulently anti-Israel BDS leader admits that he would not boycott an Israeli cure for COVID-19. Now, this guy, what's his name? Omar Bar-Ghoudi is his name. He's made statements like, we oppose a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian will ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine. And it says, let's see, believes Israel has no, and he said Israel has no right to exist. But he says that if Israel discovers a cure for the, she says Chinese virus, then cooperation with the Jewish state would be acceptable. So here you have the hypocrite in chief, the guy that has founded the BDS movement, boycott, divest, sanction Israel movement. Say, you know, destroy their economy so we can destroy the Jewish people. And this is the means in what they're going to do this, is now saying, well, if they find a cure for the virus, then we would accept a cure. And I would be thinking, dude, you would be the last one to get a vaccine. Or at least, well, I can't say that. I would hope so. But, you know, come on. If you're going to be that much of a hypocrite, you know, you ought to just step down and go someplace else. All right, we're going to close the show out for the day. I've talked long enough. I've been missing, an hour and a half. I only had one break. I think I only played one thing. Oh, Flycatch is here. Hey, Fly, thank you for coming. Borp was here tonight. We had a listener on the phone, jumped over to Facebook, had Chris Claus was over there. Chris, I'm going to be getting to you here momentarily. I see this all these messages here on Skype. I'll be answering that, and we're going to be setting this up. I'll go ahead and plug it right now. It looks like Chris Claus, one of the panelists on our Real Interfaith Dialogue on Sundays, Crossing the Crescent Discussion Group, will be having a debate this Sunday with Asana, and I can't pronounce Asana's last name. And Asana, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry, I don't want to mispronounce it. But Asana is a Muslim from Washington State, and they're going to be debating, and it looks like Romans 1:17, and how it can apply to every religion. You know what? I know what Romans chapter 1 discusses. Romans chapter 1 is actually, I mean, if you read the book of Romans, most people that read the book of Romans that are not Christians will admit that Paul was a first-rate philosophical thinker. But Romans is more or less the legalistic tomb for Christians to follow. Verse 17 says, "For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as written, the just shall live by faith." There you go. Yeah, the just shall live by faith. Which faith is that? This is when he's speaking here. He's talking about the faith of Abraham. As a matter of fact, you jump over. I'm getting into it, Chris. I'm not going to take your thunder away. That looks like a great debate. So I'm going to go ahead and plug that for you, sir. And I'll moderate it, and I'll look at and see what the format you're going to follow and how that's going to be handled. Again, everybody, thank you again for coming to tonight's show. We'll be back here once again next Tuesday evening. Y'all stay safe, self-distance, quarantine yourself if you have to, and God bless us all. We'll see y'all next Tuesday. I'm trying to play this other. I want to play this other song here as I exit. God bless. this is in commemoration of the crazy times we're going through now. People on Facebook can't hear it, so I'm going to go ahead and end the Facebook. God bless everybody.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.